Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and Valentine's Day is nearly here. Love is in the air, and happily for us, on the page. I've consulted all the lists and found a bouquet of titles guaranteed to delight. And hey, guys, we're not talking about mushy romance novels. Nope, I promise. Our special Valentine's show has a few surprises for you. Will you be mine? For the next moments, as we turn to page one of the book report. From best-selling author Nancy Horan comes Under the Wide and Starry Sky, her much-anticipated second novel, the improbable love story of Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson and his tempestuous American wife, Fanny. At age 35, Fanny Vandergrift Osborne left her philandering husband in San Francisco to set sail for Belgium with her three children and nanny in tow. She wanted to study art and to start over. Not long after her arrival, tragedy struck, and Fanny and her children come to a quiet artist colony in France where she could recuperate. Emerging from a deep sorrow, she met Robert Louis Stevenson, a lively Scot 10 years her junior. He fell in love with the earthy, independent, and opinionated Belle Americaine. Fanny did not immediately take to the slender young lawyer, who longed to devote his life to writing. In time, though, she succumbed to his charms, and the two began a fierce love affair, marked by intense joy and harrowing darkness, one that spanned the decades and the globe. Kirsten Potter narrates.
He was a bachelor and quite rich, judging from his itinerary and impeccable clothes. His soft black ringlets framed an unlined forehead, round pink cheeks, and the lips of a puto. She had glanced at Sammy next to her, pushing his peas onto a spoon with his left thumb. "Watch how Mr. Hendricks does it," she whispered in the boy's ear. "I can see you have metal, Mrs. Osborne," the surgeon said. "Do you have any French?"
"I don't, but Belle knows a little."
Hendricks emitted a worried hum. "If the old world is to work its magic, you'll need to learn the language. Flemish is spoken in Belgium, but French is a close second. If you plan to travel at all, that's the better language."
"Then we all must learn it."
Having determined the fastest route to the mother's affections, the surgeon smilingly made his offer. "I would be happy to teach you a few phrases." Every afternoon for the remainder of the journey, he had conducted language lessons for her and the children in the ship's library. Now she told Hendricks, "Don't ask about the sleeping accommodations quite yet. Give me a few moments." Fanny glanced over at her daughter, Belle, who shared an umbrella with the nanny. She beckoned the girl, then bent down to her older boy.
"Go to Miss Kate, Sammy," she said. "You too, Hervey."
She lifted the four-year-old and carried him to the governess. "Do keep in the background with the children, Kate," Fanny told the young woman, who took Hervey into her arms. "It's best the officials don't see our whole entourage. Belle, you come with me." The girl's eyes pleaded as she ducked under her mother's umbrella.
"Do I have to?"
"You needn't say a word." Looking distraught would be no challenge for Belle right now. The wind had whipped the girl's dark hair into a bird's nest. Brown crescents hung below her eyes.
"We're almost there, darling."
Fanny Osborne grabbed her daughter's hand and pushed through a sea of shoulders to reach the circle of officials. Of the Belgians, only one, a lanky, gray-headed man, had a promising aspect. He started with surprise when Fanny rested a gloved hand on his forearm.
"Do you understand English, sir?" she asked him.
He nodded.
"We are ladies traveling alone."
The official, a foot taller than she, stared down at her, rubbing his forehead. Beneath the hand, cupped over his brow, his eyes traveled artlessly from her mouth to her waist.
"We have come all the way from New York and have experienced nothing but chivalry from the English officers on our ship. Surely there must be some way..."
The Belgian shifted from foot to foot while he looked off to the side of her head.
"Sir," Fanny said, engaging his eyes. Sir, we entrust ourselves to your courtesy. In a matter of minutes, the plump little surgeon was trundling their luggage onto the pier. On deck, the other passengers fumed as a customs man lifted the lids of Fanny's trunks, gave the contents a perfunctory glance, and motioned for her party to move through the gate. Someone shouted at the officials as Fanny and her family, along with Mr. Hendricks, followed a porter who loaded their trunks on a cart and led them toward an open, horse-drawn wagon with enormous wheels. Near the terminal, masses of people waited beneath a metal canopy. Women in headscarves sat on stuffed grain sacks clutching their earthly valuables. Babies, food baskets, rosaries, satchels. One woman clasped a violin case to her chest. "They come from all over," said the surgeon as he helped the children into the wagon. "They're running from some war or potato field. This is their last stop before America. You can be sure the pickpockets are working tonight." Fanny shuddered. Her hand went to her breast to make certain the pouch of bills sewn into her corset was secure, and then to her skirt pocket, where she felt the smooth curve of her derringer.
We've just heard Under the Wide and Starry Sky by Nancy Horan. Robin Olivera was born and raised near Albany, New York, but now lives outside of Seattle. She earned her BA in Russian, then continued her studies at the Pushkin Language Institute in Moscow. After returning from Russia, she worked for years as a registered nurse. In 2006, Robin received an MFA in writing from Vermont College of Fine Arts. Her debut novel, My Name is Mary Sutter, received numerous awards for historical fiction. Now she's written I Always Loved You, a recounting of the tumultuous and passionate relationship between Mary Cassatt and Edgar Degas, a novel that brilliantly captures the Belle Époque in Paris. Welcome, Robin, and thank you for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, thank you for having me, Elaine.
What drew you to the story of Mary Cassatt and Edgar Degas?
What drew me was a fact I learned when I was on a trip to Paris. And that was that at the end of her life, Mary Cassatt burned all her letters to Edgar Degas and all his letters to her, which she had retrieved her letters to him just after he died, kept them and then burned them. And that intrigued me because all her other letters to friends and family survived. So I began to wonder what happened between them, and that was the kernel of the story.
Tell us how they met.
They met because Edgar Degas, who was sort of the de facto leader of the Impressionists, heard that Mary Cassatt, whose art he admired but whom he had never met, heard that she was rejected from the Paris Salon, the big Paris art show. And so he begged for an introduction from a friend, and he went to see her and invited her to join the Impressionists, the only American artist ever invited by the Impressionists to join them.
Talk for a minute about the Paris Salon. Who made it up and who decided who could exhibit their paintings at the show?
The Paris Salon was the yearly art show put on by the École des Beaux-Arts, which is the School of Fine Arts in Paris. It was run by the state, essentially, and it was a juried show, and the juries were generally academic artists. And the academic art in Paris at the time, surprisingly, was very strict. And the Impressionists were breaking out of that mold, and the Salon was furious with them. They started to reject every Impressionist who submitted to the Salon. The ones we love now, Renoir and Edward Manet and Claude Monet. And that was sort of the beginning of the Impressionist movement.
And tell us more about that group. For example, we all know about Monet and his home in Giverny. And were they successful? Were they starving artists?
That group was varied, interestingly enough. Some of them were starving. Claude Monet and Auguste Renoir were fast friends in the early 1870s and late 1860s. And they were literally starving. Monet moved out of the city of Paris just so that he could start a garden in order to feed his family. Others were more aristocratic. For instance, Berthe Morisot came from a fairly aristocratic family. Her father was high up in the government in France, and money for her was not as much as an issue. Edgar Degas came from a very aristocratic family. In fact, the spelling of his name used to be separated with a small D, D-E, and then a capital G-A-S. And the problem that Degas faced was that his father lost all his money in a bad venture supporting another son. So Degas went from a very aristocratic family with lots of money to, in fact, a starving artist. So across the spectrum, you had every kind of class and economic social level.
Describing Mary early in the book, you wrote, she'd been trying for half her lifetime to find her soul, and still she hadn't. Tell us more about Mary's early struggles with her art.
Well, Mary Cassatt came from Philadelphia, from a sort of a highly placed mercantile family, and she started studying in Philadelphia and rebelliously then moved to Paris against her father's wishes. She was not allowed to join the many ateliers in the city of Paris because she was a woman. It was restricted to men. There was one atelier where women were accepted, but she found the whole system rather restrictive. So she, being the independent soul that she was, traveled to Italy and Switzerland and Spain and found mentors outside of the system. She did what a lot of people did then, which was copy the masters, and it was in the copying of the masters that you were supposed to be able to devise their secrets. But after 10 years of this, with an interruption for the Prussian War, she had to go back home because Paris was under siege. She crafted she cobbled together an education for herself, which was unconventional.
I was fascinated to read that Mary was actually friends with Abigail Alcott, the sister of Louisa May Alcott. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely true, yes. Abigail May Alcott, she was called May, but I had to change it in the story because Mary and May together was impossible for people's eyes to differentiate them.
Yeah.
Lived in Paris as an art student, just like Mary Cassatt, during the years that I write about in the book. And she even wrote a guide for Americans who wanted to come to the city of Paris to study art. She told them what to buy and where to live and how to get into the art studios. She had a minor literary success to her sisters.
Share a bit about the relationship between Manet and Berthe Morisot. Berthe actually married Manet's brother?
Berthe did marry Edward Manet's brother. Now, some people might not be as familiar with Edward Manet as they are with Claude Monet. Edward Manet is widely considered to be the initial rebel that started to shake things up in the 1860s. And Berthe Morisot knew him because she was starting to paint then, too. And if you read her diaries very closely, you'll see that she fell into a depression and she was in love with Edward Manet. But Edward Manet had married someone else very young, and so she was mourning the loss of her love for him. And her mother, who was getting really exasperated with her, arranged essentially a marriage between Eugene Manet, Edward's brother, and Berthe Morisot. And the odd thing was is that the brothers almost looked like twins. So Berthe Morisot was in this very uncomfortable position for much of her life.
We're speaking with Robin Oliveira on the Book Report. How did the relationship between Edgar and Mary evolve? Were they ever married?
Edgar Degas and Mary Cassatt never married. They never married anybody else either. And Mary Cassatt was ambivalent about marriage. She saw that if you married as a woman, you would most certainly get pregnant, and then your life would change. You'd never be independent again as a woman. And so that tugged on her, which is rather ironic considering the fact that later in her life she became known for her mother and child pictures, which depicted a family life that she never achieved for herself.
You know, I've always wondered, and perhaps you can shed some light on it, what was behind Degas' fascination with ballet dancers?
That's a very interesting question. His father, aside from being what turned out to be a very poor banker, was a musician, and he loved music. And Degas spent his childhood with musicians in the home in the evenings. You know, back then there was no television, and so their evenings were spent in one another's houses. They had these what they called evenings, and so somebody would take Monday night and someday Tuesday night, and they would go around to one another's homes. And a feature of the Degas evening were extraordinary musicians, and his father took him to the opera. And I think it was a childhood love that then extended to painting the ballerinas, because back then it wasn't just ballet, it was opera and ballet together, and the ballet dancers would dance in the opera. So it became connected, and I also think he had just had a love of beauty, you know.
Well, are you already at work on your next novel?
I am. I just recently finished this, but I am. I know what's going to happen, and I'm eager to get into it. And just as a hint, I'll be spending some time in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Oh, all right. Well, readers, I want you to know that this was a very compelling story, and I want to thank you so much, Robin, for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
All righty. And now let's listen to a sampling of I Always Loved You, narrated by Mohsen Morneau.
She removed her glasses and wiped her watering eyes. Oh, to see as she once had. Some mornings upon waking, she indulges herself. Today I will paint the lace on the dress, finish the flowers in the background, and then concentrate on the way the sun plays on the girl's hair. And then she opens her eyes, and a milky scrim obscures even the bedposts. Mary replaced her glasses and willed her blurring eyes to focus on the jumble of brushes and palette knives and dismantled easels. Under this purposeful gaze, their forms sharpened and fell away and became the contour and outline she needed them to be. For half a century, she had shifted sight like this at will, though when she was young, when she was first beginning to paint, the effort had pained her. It is a way of thinking, her instructors had said. It is a way of being in the world. And with that shift, the half-moon shape of the box revealed itself, protruding from under the edge of the tarpaulin. Kneeling, she felt its rounded edge and exhaled. Tucking it under her arm, she shuffled to the far end of the room, where Mathilde had left the tea tray for her on the table by the hearth, along with the magnifying glass she required. Mary sank into the chair and opened the lid. It was the kind of box that harbors forgotten photographs or mismatched buttons, so ordinary that after her death they might have tossed it without checking the contents, but she couldn't take that chance. And besides, their curiosity had dogged her all her life. She would not let it dog her death. She was not sentimental, though people believed she was, seduced perhaps by the expressions she had rendered in her paintings. But she didn't know, really, what people thought of her, and she didn't care. Her work, like his, was all the legacy she cared to bequeath to the world. But she had kept these letters, as he had kept hers, though what they had been thinking she couldn't imagine. Such recklessness! Private conversations should always remain private. Why should anyone know what they themselves had barely known? And even if something had once been committed to paper, did it mean that it was still true? Always true? Unlike the relative permanence of paint, words were temporal. You uttered them and they evanesced, but if you wrote them, they remained. Though whether the written word was any more truthful than the spoken was a mystery to her. Only paint was honest. But even a painting could be wiped clean and refined. He was forever revising, stealing his paintings back to rework them, everything always unfinished with him. She fingered the scalloped tendril of faded pink ribbon that bound the letters. She had chosen ribbon instead of string because it reminded her of his danseuse's bright sashes, their pink and green bows, lush and extravagant in their fullness. Somehow, he had made even the sashes seem to dance, though it was the dancers themselves he'd imbued with the verve that now enchanted all of Paris. Motion captured. Later, after he had painted every position, rehearsal, ensemble, and pose, he began to paint women in the most unflattering way, as if to negate any vestige of the romance his ballet pictures had cultivated. He had been an uncompromising man, stubborn and ironic, hence ribbons to goad as much as to honor. At his funeral, she had wept. How could she not? And even that reasonable grief, had they not been friends above all, had fanned the old rumors. The whispers about their friendship, their romance, their affair, ask anyone in Paris, they all had an opinion, had not dampened after his death. 9 years now. She had helped to arrange the sale of all his paintings afterward. His studio had been crammed with work, though it seemed impossible since his blindness should have eliminated any further possibility of his working, as it had her.
That was I Always Loved You by Robin Oliveira. Blending literature and memoir, Anne Patchett examines her deepest commitments to writing, family, friends, dogs, books, and her husband in This Is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Together, these essays, previously published in The Atlantic, Harper, Vogue, and The Washington Post, form a resonant portrait of a life lived with loyalty and love. Stretching from her childhood to present day, the work, narrated by the author, covers a disastrous early marriage to a later happy one, relationships with family and friends, the hard work and joy of writing, and the unexpected thrill of opening a bookstore.
The tricky thing about being a writer or about being any kind of artist is that in addition to making art, you also have to make a living. My short stories and novels have always filled my life with meaning, but, at least in the first decade of my career, they were no more capable of supporting me than my dog was. But part of what I love about both novels and dogs is that they are so beautifully oblivious to economic concerns. We serve them, and in return, they thrive. It isn't their responsibility to figure out where the rent is coming from. What I was looking for in a job was simple enough, something that would allow me to pay the bills and still leave me time to write. At first, I thought the key would be to put the burden on my back rather than my brain, and so I worked as a restaurant cook and later as a waitress. And I was right. There was plenty of room in my head for stories, but because I fell asleep the minute I stopped moving, very few of those stories were ever written down. Once I realized that physical labor wasn't the answer, I switched to teaching, the universally suggested career for all MFA graduates. And while I wasn't so tired, days spent attending to the creativity of others often left me uninterested in any sort of creativity of my own. Food service and teaching were the only two paying jobs I thought I was qualified for. And once I discovered that neither of them met my requirements, I was at a loss. Could I follow the example of Wallace Stevens and sell insurance? All I knew for certain was that I had to figure out how to both eat and write. The answer, at least the first spark of it, came in the form of a 250-word book review of Amy Tan's novel The Joy Luck Club. I had published several short stories in 17 magazine and had asked my editor, Adrian Nicole LeBlanc, both of us 25 at the time, if I could have a nonfiction assignment as well. The economics were easy enough to figure out. 17 ran one short story a month, 12 stories a year, and if I was doing my absolute best, I could never hope for more than one or two of those spots. A writer of nonfiction, on the other hand, could publish an article in every issue, sometimes multiple articles in a single issue. I had finally identified a job that I more or less knew how to do that would be neither mentally nor physically exhausting. Which is not to say that it wasn't aggravating at times. I was asked to rewrite that book review half a dozen times, and each time I was told I had to consider yet another aspect of the novel. My word count was not increased to match these new points of interest, and more words in meant that somewhere other words had to come out. So I trimmed and tucked, found a single word to express 5 words worth of feeling. I explored the realm of mother-daughter relationships on the head of a pin. Once my book review was accepted, I started pitching ideas for articles to Adrian, who took the better ones to her boss, Robbie Myers. Unlike in my fiction, where I prided myself on making things up, I found these articles wanted personal experience. For every 10 story ideas I came up with, growing up with horses, or when your best friend's a guy, or how to decorate your locker, I would be given the green light to write one of them, without contract or kill fee. And for every 10 I was allowed to write, maybe one would actually make its way into the magazine. The one that was accepted would then be rewritten 10 times as I received round after round of notes, not only from Adrian and Robbie, but from various editors in other departments and all their interns who were honing their own editorial skills. I never felt that way when I was 15, read the note most regularly penciled in the margins. And while I wanted to say, "Did you grow up in Tennessee? Did you go to a Catholic girls' school? Did you stay home with your parents on weekends and never go on a single date?" I refrained. If they wanted to see themselves reflected in my piece, I would put them there. I would find a way to wedge in every single one of them and stay within the confines of my word count.
That was This is the Story of a Happy Marriage by Ann Patchett. Author Leanne Moriarty creates a wonderfully fun, insightful novel about the crazy things we do for love. In The Hypnotist Love Story, Ellen O'Farrell is a bit unusual. She's a hypnotherapist. She's never met her father, and she can't seem to get a relationship going. When Ellen meets Patrick, she's hopeful. But when he says he needs to tell her something, she fears the worst. When Patrick reveals his ex-girlfriend is stalking him, Ellen thinks, "Is that all? Actually, that's kind of neat." She's more intrigued than frightened. What makes a supposedly smart professional woman behave this way? She'd love to meet her. What she doesn't know is, she already has. Tamara Lovett Smith narrates.
I could sense her happiness. It radiated off her, sickly, like cheap perfume. Not that she would ever wear cheap perfume. I tasted sour jealousy in my mouth and helped myself to a chocolate to make it go away. "Oh, good. I'll have one too," said the hypnotist, unwrapping the chocolate with warm, girly camaraderie like we were old friends. She is that sort of girl. She probably has a whole circle of giggly, supportive, lovely girlfriends, the sort that hug each other hello and have Sex in the City DVD nights and long, shrieky telephone conversations about men. She opened a notepad on her lap and spoke with her mouth adorably full of chocolate. She said, "Now, before we do anything, I'm going to ask you a few questions." Oh dear, I shouldn't have chosen the caramel. Chewy. I hadn't expected so many questions. For the most part, I answered honestly. They were innocuous enough. A bit pathetic, even. "What do you do for a living? What do you do to relax? What's your favorite food?" Finally, the hypnotist sat back in her armchair, smiled, and said, "And tell me, why are you here today?" Of course, my answer to that one wasn't 100% truthful. He said, "There's something I need to tell you." He had placed his knife and fork on the edge of his plate, and now he was sitting up straight, with his shoulders back as though he was finally ready to face the music. He seemed fearful and slightly ashamed. Ellen, who had been smiling, instantly felt a painful cramp knot her stomach. A part of her mind registered this, the way her body responded first. The mind-body-spirit connection in action. So fascinating. Her happy, open smile stayed foolishly frozen on her face. She was 35 years old. She knew what this meant. This nice man, this self-employed suburban surveyor, this single dad who liked camping and cricket and country music, was about to say something that would put her off her barramundi and white wine sauce. He was about to say something that would ruin her day. And it had been such a lovely day, and the barramundi was really very good. She put down her fork regretfully. "What's that?" she said, her tone pleasantly quizzical, and every muscle in her body tightened as if she was preparing to be punched. She would cope. It wouldn't be the end of the world. It was only their fourth date. She hadn't invested that much of herself. She barely knew the man. For heaven's sake, he liked country music. That should have been a red flag from the beginning. Yes, she had been indulging in some hopeful daydreams in the bath tonight, but that was a common pitfall of dating. She was already moving on, working on her recovery. She would be over it by Wednesday. Thursday, at the latest. Thank the Lord she hadn't slept with him. She couldn't control what was about to happen, only her response to it. For a moment she saw her mother, eyes lifted to heaven. "Ellen, tell me, my darling, do you truly believe this facile self-help nonsense you spout?" She did, in fact, with all her heart. Her mother later apologized for her comment. "That may have been patronizing," she'd said, and Ellen had pretended to faint in shock. "Actually, can you excuse me for a minute?" He stood up and his napkin slid to the floor. He picked it up, his face flushed, and carefully laid it on the table next to his plate. She looked up at him. "I'll just..." He gestured at the back of the restaurant. "All right," she said soothingly. "Over there to your left, sir." A waiter discreetly pointed in the direction of the toilets. She watched him go. Patrick Scott. She didn't really like the name Patrick anyway. It was a mamby-pamby sort of name. You could imagine your hairdresser being called Patrick. Also, his male friends apparently called him Scotty, which was, well, perfectly acceptable, really, in that Aussie blokey way. If he ended it, it would definitely hurt. Just a little sting, but a sharp one. There was nothing extraordinarily wonderful about Patrick Scott. He had an ordinary, pleasant face, long, thin, slightly receding hairline, an ordinary body, average height, quite broad shoulders, but naturally broad. Not look at me, I work out broad. An ordinary job, an ordinary life.
That was The Hypnotist Love Story by Leanne Moriarty. In the future, love is complicated, and death is not necessarily the end. Love Minus 80 by Will McIntosh follows several interconnected people in a disquieting vision of romantic life in the century to come. There's Rob, who accidentally kills a jogger, then sacrifices all to visit her in a cryogenic dating facility. He seeks forgiveness, but instead falls in love. Veronica, a shy dating coach, finds herself coaching the very woman who is stealing the man she loves. And Mira, a gay woman accidentally placed in a heterosexual dating center, now desperately seeks a way to reunite with her frozen partner as the years pass. In this daring and big-hearted novel, based on the Hugo Award-winning short story, the lovelorn navigate a world in which technology has reached the outer limits of morality and romance. An ensemble cast narrates.
The woman across the aisle from Rob yammered on as the Micro T rose above street level, threading through the Peridot building, lit offices buzzing past in a colorful blur. He should have taken his scamp. Public transport was simpler, but he always seemed to share a compartment with someone who didn't have the courtesy to sub-vocalize. For no reason except that she was annoying the shit out of him, Rob decided to scan her to see how much work she'd had done on her face. As his fingers danced over the skin-tight system on his left arm, the woman glanced his way and curled her lip, a micro-expression that was there and gone in a flicker. Now he had another reason to dislike this complete stranger. No, his style wasn't elegant and seamless, and he was tired of being judged by the technological glitterati as lacking some vital core because he only cared about making his system function, not how he looked doing it. A flashing grid superimposed itself over the jabbering woman's face. He grinned, satisfied. Nose work, lip work, eye work, chin work. There wasn't much to her that was original. It was petty of him to check, even more petty to take satisfaction in her artificiality, but she was truly bugging him. "I wasn't the one who told him," the woman was saying to some guy's screen. "Ask Corey if you don't believe me." She was naked, except for her skin-tight system running upper thigh to mid-chest, which was a 5'5 manatee, totally state-of-the-art, glittering like blue-green jewels on her skin. The screen she was speaking to, which was huge and floating 2 feet from Rob's head, was muted. The unshaven face framed in it looked sleepy, or maybe just uninterested. "Since when don't you like Corey?" the woman asked in response to something the guy said. "So you don't like any of my friends, is that it?" She had no class. If a conversation was going to be intense, you did it in person. She probably showed up for weddings and funerals via screen. He could mute her, but her gesticulating form would only be more distracting if her mouth was moving soundlessly. Rob decided to go to screen himself and see what Lorelai was up to. Of course, that meant working his system again, and another contemptuous micro-sneer. Lorelai was in their bedroom. She was utterly surrounded by screens. Rob was stunned at how many people were watching her, and she was adding more by the second. Onlookers' eager screens jockeyed for the best vantage point, rolling and shifting like rectangular gnats, scooting low to corners of the room, all shrunk to palm size to accommodate the crowd. Yes, Lorelai was a total attention hound, but she'd never scored, he called up the stats on his screen, 182 simultaneous viewers before. Lorelai actually looked nervous, kneeling on her bed in the midst of the storm, probably terrified she might blow it by saying something stale or letting the pace of whatever she was doing drag. What was she doing? Rob zoomed in on the stack of greeting cards in her hand just as she activated the one on top. "Aw, how cute. Love to Robbie from Grandma on your sweet 16. She grunted, flipped the card over her shoulder toward a scattered mess that Rob recognized as his journals, remote photo files, all the personal stuff he kept in his lockbox. As Rob's heart began to hammer, Lorelai activated the next card. "Oh, here we go. I knew it." He could see it was the one from Penny, the one Rob had almost thrown out when he moved in with Lorelai. A rush of rage, threaded with tendrils of guilt, hit him as Lorelai read the card aloud. "To Rob. Okay, fine. If it'll make you happy. XXX. Penny."
That was Love Minus 80 by Will McIntosh. James Salter, a Penn Faulkner winner, offers up All That Is, a sweeping, seductive, deeply moving story set in the years after World War II. After his experiences as a young naval officer in battles off Okinawa, Philip Bowman returns to America and finds a position as a book editor. It's a time when publishing is still largely a private affair, a scattered family of small houses here and in Europe, a time of gatherings in fabled apartments and conversations that continue long into the night. In this world of dinners, deals, and literary careers, Bowman fits in perfectly. But despite his success, love eludes him. His first marriage goes bad, then another fails to happen. Then, he finally meets a woman who enthralls him and sets him on a course he could never have imagined. Romantic and haunting, All That Is, performed by Joe Barrett, explores a life unfolding in a world on the brink of change.
In June, the invasion began. The Japanese had dangerous naval forces in the area, heavy cruisers and battleships. Two marine divisions went ashore, and an army division followed. It became, for the Japanese, the Saipan disaster. 20 days later, nearly all of them had perished. The Japanese general, and also Admiral Nagumo, who had commanded at Midway, committed suicide. And hundreds of civilians, men and women terrified of being slaughtered, some of them mothers holding babies in their arms, leapt from the steep cliffs to their death on the sharp rocks below. It was the knell. The bombing of the main islands of Japan was now possible, and in the most massive of the raids, a firebombing of Tokyo, more than 80,000 people died in the huge inferno in a single night. Next, Iwo Jima fell. The Japanese pronounced an ultimate pledge, the death of 100 million, the entire population, rather than surrender. In the path of it lay Okinawa. Day was rising, a pale Pacific dawn that had no real horizon, with the tops of the early clouds gathering light. The sea was empty. Slowly the sun appeared, flooding across the water and turning it white. A Lieutenant J.G. named Bowman had come on deck and was standing at the railing, looking out. His cabin mate, Kimmel, silently joined him. It was a day Bowman would never forget. Neither would any of them. "Anything out there?" "Nothing." "Not that you can see," Kimmel said. He looked forward, then aft. "It's too peaceful," he said. Bowman was navigation officer, and also, he had learned just 2 days earlier, lookout officer. "Sir," he had asked, "what does that entail?" "Here's the manual," the exec said. "Read it." He began that night, turning down the corner of certain pages as he read. "What are you doing?" Kimmel asked. "Don't bother me right now." "What are you studying?" "A manual." "Jesus, we're in the middle of enemy waters and you're sitting there reading a manual? This is no time for that. You're supposed to already know what to do." Bowman ignored him. They had been together from the beginning, since midshipman school, where the commandant, a Navy captain whose career had collapsed when his destroyer ran aground, had a copy of a message to Garcia, an inspirational text from the Spanish-American War, placed on every man's bunk. Captain McCreary had no future, but he remained loyal to the standards of the past. He drank himself into a stupor every night, but was always crisp and well-shaved in the morning. He knew the Book of Navy Regulations by heart, and had bought the copies of A Message to Garcia with money from his own pocket. Bowman had read the message carefully. Years later, he could still recite parts of it. Garcia was somewhere in the mountain vastness of Cuba. No one knew where. The point was simple. Do your duty fully and absolutely, without unnecessary questions or excuses. Kimmel had cackled as he read it. "Aye, aye, sir. Man the guns." He was dark-haired and skinny, and walked with a loose gait that made him seem long-legged. His uniform always looked somehow slept in. His neck was too thin for his collar. The crew among themselves called him the Camel, but he had a playboy's aplomb, and women liked him. In San Diego, he had taken up with a lively girl named Vicky, whose father owned a car dealership, Palmetto Ford. She had blonde hair, pulled back, and a touch of daring. She was drawn to Kimmel immediately, his indolent glamour. In the hotel room that he had gotten with two other officers, and where, he explained, they would be away from the noise of the bar, they sat drinking Canadian Club and Coke. "How did it happen?" he asked. "How did what happen?" "My meeting someone like you." "You certainly didn't deserve it," she said. He laughed. "It was fate," he said. She sipped her drink. "Fate? So, am I going to marry you?" "Jesus, are we there already? I'm not old enough to get married." "You'd probably only deceive me about 10 times in the first year," she said. "I'd never deceive you. Ha ha."
We've just heard All That Is by James Salter. You know, sometimes love can just be fun. The Book Report celebrates a light, loopy love story with The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion. This hilarious feel-good novel tells the tale of an oddly charming and socially challenged genetics professor on an unusual quest to find out if he is capable of true love. Don Tillman, professor of genetics, has never been on a second date. He is a man whose lifelong difficulty with social rituals has convinced him he is simply not wired for romance. When an acquaintance informs him he would make a wonderful husband, his first reaction is shock. Yet, he must concede to the statistical probability that there is someone for everyone. So, the professor embarks on the wife project. In the orderly, evidence-based manner with which he approaches all things, Dawn sets out to find the perfect partner. She will be punctual and logical, most definitely not a barmaid, a smoker, a drinker, or a late arriver. Yet, Rosie Jarman is all these things. She is also beguiling, fiery, intelligent, and on a quest of her own. She's looking for her biological father, a search in which a certain DNA expert might be able to help. Dawn's wife project takes a back burner to the father project, and an unlikely relationship blooms, forcing the scientifically minded geneticist to confront the spontaneous whirlwind that is Rosie. Dan O'Grady narrates.
I am 39 years old, tall, fit, and intelligent, with a relatively high status and above average income as an associate professor. Logically, I should be attractive to a wide range of women. In the animal kingdom, I would succeed in reproducing. However, there is something about me that women find unappealing. I have never found it easy to make friends, and it seems that the deficiencies that cause this problem have also affected my attempts at romantic relationships. The apricot ice cream disaster is a good example. Claudia had introduced me to one of her many friends. Elizabeth was a highly intelligent computer scientist with a vision problem that had been corrected with glasses. I mentioned the glasses because Claudia showed me a photograph and asked me if I was okay with them. An incredible question from a psychologist. In evaluating Elizabeth's suitability as a potential partner, someone to provide intellectual stimulation, to share activities with, perhaps even to breed with, Claudia's first concern was my reaction to her choice of glasses frames, which was probably not even her own but the result of advice from an optometrist. This is the world I have to live in. Then Claudia told me, as though it was a problem, she has very firm ideas. Are they evidence-based? I guess so, Claudia said. Perfect. She could have been describing me. We met at a Thai restaurant. Restaurants are minefields for the socially inept, and I was nervous as always in these situations. But we got off to an excellent start when we both arrived at exactly 7 p.m. as arranged. Poor synchronization is a huge waste of time. We survived the meal without her criticizing me for any social errors. It is difficult to conduct a conversation while wondering whether you are looking at the correct body part, but I locked onto her bespectacled eyes, as recommended by Jean. This resulted in some inaccuracy in the eating process, which she did not seem to notice. On the contrary, we had a highly productive discussion about simulation algorithms. She was so interesting. I could already see the possibility of a permanent relationship. The waiter brought the dessert menus, and Elizabeth said, I don't like Asian desserts. This was almost certainly an unsound generalization, based on limited experience, and perhaps I should have recognized it as a warning sign. But it provided me with an opportunity for a creative suggestion. We could get an ice cream across the road. Great idea, as long as they've got apricot. I assessed that I was progressing well at this point and did not think the apricot preference would be a problem. I was wrong. The ice cream parlour had a vast selection of flavours, but they had exhausted their supply of apricot. I ordered a chocolate chili and licorice double cone for myself and asked Elizabeth to nominate her second preference. If they haven't got apricot, I'll pass. I couldn't believe it. All ice cream tastes essentially the same, due to chilling of the taste buds. This is especially true of fruit flavours. I suggested mango. No thanks, I'm fine. I explained the physiology of taste bud chilling in some detail. I predicted that if I purchased a mango and peach ice cream, she would be incapable of differentiating. And by extension, either would be equivalent to apricot. They're completely different, she said. If you can't tell mango from peach, that's your problem. Now, we had a simple objective disagreement that could readily be resolved experimentally. I ordered a minimum size ice cream in each of the two flavours. But by the time the serving person had prepared them and I turned to ask Elizabeth to close her eyes for the experiment, she had gone. So much for evidence-based and for computer scientist. Afterwards, Claudia advised me that I should have abandoned the experiment prior to Elizabeth leaving. Obviously, but at what point? Where was the signal? These are the subtleties I failed to see. But I also failed to see why heightened sensitivity to obscure cues about ice cream flavours should be a prerequisite for being someone's partner. It seems reasonable to assume that some women do not require this. Unfortunately, the process of finding them is impossibly inefficient. The apricot ice cream disaster had cost a whole evening of my life, compensated for only by the information about simulation algorithms.
We've just heard The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion. Readers, as Goethe said, we are shaped and fashioned by what we love. Of course, one of our great loves is a thoroughly engaging book. I hope I've presented one or two to fulfill your literary desires. Look for more ideas on my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Have a memorable Valentine's Day, and let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.